Hello, my name is Tori Whitaker Martinez, and I'm the lead editor for Infection Control Today. And today I have the honor of having Vanjie Dennis back with us again today. She was the president of the National AORN Conference, and she is back, and we're going to be talking about surgical smoke. So thank you, Vanjie, for being back with me today.
Thank you, Tori. It's an absolute honor to be able to talk about a subject I'm so passionate about and been involved with several of my professional colleagues in trying to make a difference in the United States for the exposure to surgical smoke for all people. It is a hazard that sometimes we've been doing it for so many years because electrosurgery and lasers and ultrasonic scalpels have been around for so long. It is just part of the culture. And now, just like ergonomics, hands-free passing, not sticking yourself with needles, all this is falls under the same category as we've got to start protecting our healthcare personnel and providers.
Absolutely.
Well, if we talk about our exposure, and let me go ahead and add that addition to it, the patients are affected by the surgical smoke. What about the patient under monitored anesthesia care delivery? We can't obviously, under that sedation, remove all the smoke in the room unless we evacuate it. What about the baby's first breath on a C-section? Think about things like that. Or even, we're not even talking about the patients here. Now, let's resort back to the nurse that's pregnant and it passes the placental barrier. That baby, that unborn baby, is exposed to surgical smoke. So it goes beyond the gamut of what we think. It does it involve the nurse, the tech, the anesthetist, or anesthesiologist, and the doctor? It really affects everybody in that perioperative platform when we generate smoke.
Wow, I never thought about that. So let me jump into my first question. And it is for those unfamiliar with surgical smoke, how does smoke generated by lasers differ from smoke produced by electrosurgery? And why does that distinction matter for safety?
Well, in fact, any heat-generated device will create surgical plume or smoke. And you will hear me interchangeably use plume and smoke because we've got different professional organizations that call it one or the other. So I definitely want my audience to know the difference. What occurs, whether it's a laser, electrosurgery, a high-speed drill that creates aerosolization of particulates, or an ultrasonic scalpel that also creates that type of particulates in the air, it's all bad for you. Each mechanism of production has what we refer to as a wet rate of work depending on the heat distribution of that device. So I always laugh and tease. I say this respectfully, over 40-something years in lasers. So that's kind of where I got my first exposure to any type of surgical smoke. And it never made sense to me. We are purchasing smoke evacuators automatically when you purchased a laser, but yet we're generating surgical smoke with an electrosonic device or an ultrasonic scalpel. And I did a lot of physician courses, and I remember going to a hospital and coordinated a physician course, and it was just baffling me. And I finally went up to one of the docs and I said, Dr. So-and-so, Dr. X, we'll call him. I said, why are we not differentiating between anything that creates smoke? And I use it as a lot of my platform when I'm teaching. In short, he said, there's no such thing as safe smoke. So it's like an analogy, a very poor analogy, I guess, but it still explains it very well. I said, it's like shooting yourself with a gun or a rifle. It doesn't matter. You're still getting the particulates. Now, if I had to, for purposes of our audience, differentiate in particle size and composition differences, I would say laser plume has much smaller particles, and they run at around 0.1 micron to 0.5 micron range. The velocity is pretty powerful. So the smaller the particle, the further it can travel, it will remain airborne longer and go deeper in the lungs. So that's the laser. And it's been supported since the beginning of time, I think, when I first got educated with lasers from OSHA and NIOSH, that laser smoker plume contains particulates capable of respiratory and mutagenic potential. NIOSH stated that early in the 80s and 90s. We just automatically, like I said, purchased a laser because there was so much research initially with lasers. It was new technology, and we were very concerned what this device was producing. Some of the earlier pioneers, Michael Bagish, Dr. Michael Bagish, talked about generating airborne particulates with the laser and confining rats. I like calling them mice, but they confined rats, and they saw inflammatory changes in the lung. So the microns are small with laser plume, but all, whether it's electrosurgical smoke or lasers, they still go deep in your lungs. Do a comparative with electrosurgical smoke versus laser smoke. They typically produce a larger particle, and that's usually around 0.35 to 6.5 microns. Irrelevant, it gets deep. And then you have biological or chemical compositions that are also in there. Because, I mean, if you think about smoke, cigarette smoke has been around. And a lot of the literature absolutely supports that 1 gram of tissue vaporized by a laser is equivalent to 3 unfiltered cigarettes, by an electrosurgical device, 6 unfiltered cigarettes. But we are not smoking filtered processed tobacco. With that being said, now we have chemical and biological compositions because the concentration and the production is so much heavier than a cigarette. Things that you would find in the smoke, toxic gases. Think about this: benzene, hydrogen cyanide, formaldehyde. And now we have regulations from OSHA about formaldehyde exposure. And our patients, you were talking about patients earlier in a conversation that we had offline. Carbon monoxide is absorbed in our patients when we're doing laparoscopy because the smoke binds with hemoglobin faster than oxygen does. So you have that. Other bioaerosols that include dead and living cell fragments, blood particles, and potentially viruses. Does that help a little bit?
That helps a lot. But the more you know about this, the scarier it is. I mean, it's funny because I've asked so many people if they even knew what surgical smoke was, and they had no idea. And
You
so
are 100% correct, Tori. It is the unknown. You know, it's if you don't see it, smell it, touch it, it's not real, but it is real. And we've been breathing it years and not thinking of the consequences. When anesthesia machines first came out, we didn't have scavenger systems, and the results were patients who, not patients, excuse me, staff, let me correct myself, who were exposed because the patient was confined where they didn't get the exposure. They were coming down with leukemia and lymphoma and all types of dyskinesias from the exposure of those gases because we weren't scavengering. And then the standards change requiring scavenger systems. I think that's where we're at with surgical plume or smoke. We are hoping getting legislation to push this with law from state to state. But there's other things that have to be in place. And back to what you just said is awareness. I think we'd get much more support if globally we were aware. A great example I can give you is when I was converting one of my hospitals. I won't give the name. I had five major conversions, and this one was a tough one because it was a multitude of ambulatory centers. And I had to think of a process to get movement on it instead of saying, "Will you try this, doctor?" or trying to convince the staff. And you know who I went to? Infection prevention, risk management, and quality control. And honest to goodness, the trigger was pulled and we converted within 60 days. It was not a choice. We have to educate. And of course, I had an algorithm for educating, but it is a problem. It is the unknown.
So you mentioned leukemia for this other process. What are the health hazards for surgical smoke? I mean, the first thing I thought of was I have asthma, I can't imagine being around that smoke. I can't handle being around any smoke at all. I can't imagine being around that.
Yep. Great question. There's respiratory risk. I said the smaller the part particulates, as in laser smoke, the greater ability to reach the alveoli. And in my surgical smoke presentations, I talk about the infusion of that. Once it gets into the lungs, it carries to all parts of the body. Example, smokers have a greater risk of bladder cancer. That is not any different with surgical smoke. So, in the respiratory risk, you got mutagenic potential. This has been demonstrated in white papers in vitro. Electrosurgical smoke, the same thing. So while we're saying laser smoke, electrosurgical smoke, ultrasonic, the concentrations are, but nevertheless, the respiratory risk are down almost identical. Example, electrosurgery that's used in 93 to 96% of all surgical cases versus lasers, you have more exposure to upper respiratory, visual obstruction, can't see what you're doing. And what is kind of not humorous but surprising is when we get young perioperative nurses or surgical technologists first coming in the operating room, they go, "What is that smell?" And not being used to it or acclimating to it, you get headaches, your eyes are burning a little bit. So you got huge respiratory risk. You also have infection risk. They're more likely. Tremendous amount of papers that are out there about viable viral fragments that are found, even HPV. And HPV was actually grown out, inoculated, and grew in SR. I'm not in agar, excuse me. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. It's the medium that grows the disease or infection, and proved it was viable in transmission. So they did that. Overall, they both have a high theoretical infection risk. And that's through blood particles that, depending on how hot the device is, you're going to have viable blood cells still in the surgical smoke. You don't have that with cigarettes. You have processed tobacco, and fajitas smell wonderful when it generates smoke, but not human tissue. The challenge I get when I talk about infection and respiratory protection is I tell our staff, I said, "Okay, what did you smoke today?" And somebody said, "I did a hernia repair." I said, "That's what you smoked. You smoked somebody's tissue and a hernia repair." So we don't put it in that perspective. And Dr. Kaball, who is a wonderful friend of mine and colleague and mentor, she actually did her PhD in examining, a qualitative, quantitative assessment of people who would develop COPD, respiratory incidences, asthma, adult onset asthma. And then you get the argument sometimes, "Well, that's not relative. There's just not enough number." And it was pretty significant because we're exposed every single day. And the first challenge I said, "Well, would you want that to happen to you?" Because surgical techs, anesthetists, and nurses are in there 5 to 7 days a week and on call. So their exposure rate is much higher.
Is one staff member more at risk than another?
You know, when you talk about 60 million particles being released when electrosurgery or laser is vaporizing tissue, obviously the first exposure is going to be higher to the surgical tech or the nurse that's scrubbing in the dock, as well as the anesthetist. But it's still the exposure's there, even though they may not get the concentration, the relative risk are going to be the same.
So just like secondhand smoke.
And secondhand smoke, as you well know, is proven to be just as detrimental as inhaling as the primary smoker.
That's right. So what are the symptoms, or conditions that should be looked for?
So we're saying, what are the health hazards associated with repeated exposure? Well, definitely, does it matter if you know the difference? Laser-generated smoke and electrosurgical smoke are both hazardous. They are different in how they're produced, but what they contain, is almost identical. And the concentration, you heard me say three unfiltered cigarettes versus six. And Dr. Douglas Ott did white papers. He was a biomedical engineer and a gynecologist, said that was highly underestimated. And even though there's different size in the particulates, with each will contain intact biological material. And these distinctions in particulate size may matter, but an influence may be the contaminants of whether they reach the lung. But in short, they all eventually reach the lung when you're talking about something that small. Mechanism of production, we talked about the small particles and the chemicals that are associated with it, but the respiratory risks are pretty significant there. There was an actual, in fact, she worked for me at a hospital, a dear friend of all of us, and she spoke at the Georgia Council. I would be happy to share her video that maybe our audience would see. And she was a surgical nurse, an avid runner, very much into her health, never exposed to any cigarette smoke, and died from stage four lung cancer. So we are seeing more and more examples of that, and we're trying to accumulate the exposure rate and what it's doing to the staff. But her memorial to and message to us is we can't keep exposing our healthcare people. I mean, we got shortages already. Let's take care of the people that take care of us. So it's a lot. Now, again, I'll be happy to share that video for our audience.
Yes, please do. That's awesome. And I'm sorry for your loss. It's any loss, but especially one that you feel like could have been prevented, you know.
So I didn't mean to derail a little bit, but I get very passionate about this. So what is the health hazards of repeated exposure? I think that was your question. We said that we're being exposed by ultra-fine particles. We're being exposed to toxic gases and volatile organic compounds, bioaerosols, and these are all mutagenic and carcinogenic chemicals. That's a fact. It's been proven. And over time, the constant exposure to that inhalation can contribute to the respiratory. We said that. That's the chronic cough, bronchitis-like symptoms. I know several of my friends that have, one has adult onset asthma, and the other has like stage two COPD. I mean, these are nurses I know that have been in surgery for 35, 40 years. They have increased airway activity and asthma-like symptoms, or if you already had asthma, it exacerbates it, and also reduced lung function in long-term studies. That's been proven. The chemical exposure, and I can remember this myself as a young perioperative nurse going in there. By the end of the day, especially if we're doing large smoke-generated cases, you had headaches from the smelling. And you've heard people who smoke for the first time said, "Oh yeah, I took a puff and I've got a horrible headache." Well, I guess you do. Eye irritation, nausea, fatigue, and possible long-term, as I said earlier, carcinogenic risk based on the chemical composition and the epidemiology. Then you got biological effects from the exposure, intact DNA, HPV. Lots of case studies when I'm teaching smoke, the hazards of surgical smoke, of HPV, where physicians have gotten it from smelling it all the time, whether it's genital warts and they're in their throat. And actually, one of the surgeons I work with had gotten some on his forehead. So you do have viable bacteria. Studies have proven that. Is it a theoretical risk? No, there has been documented proven risk. And the short-term exposure, besides the eyes irritating, headache, nausea, and it smells horrible. It would throw you in shock if you ever had that opportunity. The persistent inflammatory processes are very irritating, and the exposure also, again, with the re-emphasis of the risk of occupational asthma-like symptoms. So there are staff roles at higher risk: perioperative nurses, surgical techs, surgeons, and the services that are applicable to that are dermatology, gynecology is a culprit for it, plastic surgery on the breast reductions, ENT, or anything that uses these high frequency devices that produce the aerosolization and smoke and the particulates in the room.
Wow. That's scary. I
It
mean,
is very
it is
scary.
scary. And I think what's the scariest part is I don't think the average Joe, the average patient knows about it or even thinks about it. I've had two Mohs surgeries, and I can't help thinking that, I mean, I know that she used a laser or something, I don't know, but I remember smelling something and it was really gross and I didn't think too much about it, but that's essentially what that was.
That's because you're not educated. You know what we did in South Carolina as we attempt to move in legislation here is, and we did that in Georgia. Brenda Ulmer and I did, and we're in law in Georgia now for almost 3 or 4 years now, is we get with the media and let them know that exposure and what is happening to you, because we're still the most trusted profession out there. People want to take care of their nurses and their surgical techs too, most definitely.
So I'm in Ohio. Speaking of the litigation part, here in Ohio, we've passed it, correct? Can you tell me a little bit more about how this litigation is going on?
Oh my gosh, yeah. There are countries. I just talked for Canada this weekend, and I don't really put a surgical smoke or plume lecture in Canadians' laser course. It's a 2-day laser course. You know why? Because they're the provinces all the way across. It's a national mandate by their OSHA to evacuate surgical smoke. We in the United States have to go state by state by state to get that conversion. I wish we could go federal, but we're finding a little bit of resistance. California, I have Patty Owens working very hard for them to understand why they have to go to law in California. And Maryland is another state doing that. So even though Georgia and North Carolina have both converted legislatively to law, South Carolina in the middle, where hospital systems have actually got facilities in the state of South Carolina, and yet their contiguous states are evacuating smoke, we are still in the process of attempting to get conversion in our state. Legislation is a slow process, and it depends on how you get on the docks of being presented to the Republican, your Senates and everything, and the priority of what's important at the state at that time. So that means as nurses, we have to advocate and get in touch with our senators. We work with lobbyists at AORN. South Carolina has two lobbyists. We're now saying, okay, we got a policy for a system in Georgia. Why isn't it the same hospital system in South Carolina following that policy? So we've got to and convince them that it's more than just a, smelling fajitas at a grill. There is so much more in it, and it's the education. So it's getting out there and pushing it and getting our nurses and through our hospital, not a hospital association, but we want them also to collaborate, but through our nursing association for the states.
So what pushback are you getting from the federal level? I mean, what could they possibly be pushing back on?
Well, I don't think the federal level is really pushing back. The sequence of implementation occurs at a state level. I thought, well, wow, it'd be really nice, but they're leaving it as so many other things that we do politically at the state level to control that, unless it's something really, really big. Maybe one day it will be. How easy would that be to mandate it all through the United States? Because Australia's doing it, Canada's doing it. I think the United Kingdom is doing it. Others are getting on board knowing this is not good for us at all. So let's talk about the surgical mask, Tori. I can remember when we would get lasers, and oh my gosh, because I teach so much on lasers, I get these questions all the time. What surgical mask do you recommend for lasers? And I'm going, heat-generated devices create surgical smoke plume. So why are we differentiating with a laser versus an electrosurgical unit or Bovie or an ultrasonic scalpel? If you look at studies of the surgical mask, especially when COVID came about, the surgical mask is designed to protect the patient from you, not you from the patient. Even my husband said that. Well, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, it does. When you have a cough or a cold, the mask captures that, but it's not going to protect coming the other way to you. And the filtration of the mask that we presently use, pretty good, but we can't walk around wearing N95s all the time. So they kind of get residual particulates, but they're not your first line of defense. They will not protect you. And then you have other variables with masks. And I'm going to tell you, I'm just as guilty. I don't want my hair messed up, Tori. So when I tie it, I go over my ears to the back of my neck, when in reality, there's a correct way to tie them and you can't have any gaping. You're not going to optimize any protection there. And the other issue is, and this is very cultural with our perioperative teams, we wear a mask, and it was always a joke. I'd see them put them in their back pocket of their scrub and walk around, and you wear the mask all day, or it's hanging down and you're eating lunch and food's in there. When the limited life expectancy of a surgical mask is less than 30 minutes, and if you cough or sneeze, take it off, you're going to have to get another one. They're not designed to protect us from patient exposure or particulate exposure from smoke.
I knew that it's like the last line of defense,
It is.
but I can't help thinking that they could have something that would help. But obviously, the surgical masks are not it. But
No,
like
they're
you
not.
said,
And it saves, I always tell hospitals, save yourself some money. Because we got people that go, well, you need to buy a laser mask. No, you don't need to buy a laser mask. The standard surgical mask is designed to filter primarily greater than 5 micron droplets. It is not intended for submicron aerosolization, and it has no NIOSH filtration rating. It's just designed to protect the patient when we sneeze. There were some countries that were even wearing surgical masks at times. And you got to remember what the particulate size of laser smoke and surgical smoke is. I mean, electrosurgical smoke, they're much smaller. That mask is not going to protect you.
So my next question is, what engineering controls are most effective for mitigating exposure to laser and electrosurgery smoke in the OR?
Well, it's commonly referred to in our guidelines with ARN or evidence-based, and then we have a consensus group of the ANSI 136.3 and the Canadian standards, which is equivalent to the ANSI standards that came on board when lasers were first introduced. And in the ANSI standards, it is looking at nothing but lasers right now. They don't differentiate in smoke, and it states it in those standards most definitely. So if you take a look at it, people going by and wanting to buy a laser mask and thinking that will work. The first line of defense to have effective engineering controls in our operating room is basically local exhaust ventilation, referred to as LEV, smoke evacuation systems. The second thing is how you hook up. What is the characteristics of that smoke evacuator? Sometimes people, our centers, buy a smoke evacuator, and I go in there and look, and it's 15 years old. Come on, it's not going to do the job. So it's got to have high flow suction that can be regulated. And by that, it's classified at 25 to 50 cubic feet per minute that it will pull away. It needs ULPA filtration, not HEPA. ULPA filtration captures those tiny particles at 0.1 micron, which is ideal for all that's generated in our heat devices. It also must have what we call an active carbon. And what does the carbon do is it absorbs those toxic gases and odors. Then we have to have an optimal way to hook up. So optimally, a smoke evacuator, you do have inline filters at 0.1 micron that connect between the wall and the suction container, but most hospitals' wall suction is a 3 to 5 CFM cubic foot per minute. It's not adequate enough to pull that smoke out of the way. Then you got another issue. You got the competency in regulating that smoke evacuator and proper algorithms of hookup per surgical specialty. So, example, both standards with lasers and guidelines say, in essence, within inches of the source, and they specifically say about 2 inches. So if you get farther away, yeah, I have an infrared photography that shows just the corrugated tubing, not hooked to the pencil. And as they pull it away, the aerosolization is 3 or 4 feet in the room. versus capturing it 2 inches from the site of creation. So local exhaust ventilation, commonly referred to as LEV, advantages, you position it at the source, got to have algorithms so staff understands proper hookup with their specialties. They have to understand the control of the pull. If I am removing a more contained situation, like pneumoperitoneum or smoke in the belly when we're doing laparoscopy, you're not going to turn it to 50. That doesn't make sense. You're going to deinsufflate the patient, but you need to set up to where you have a contiguous pull of that surgical plume, wherever procedure we have, without interrupting surgery. We have to remember we're still in the business to do surgery. So there's dynamics there, and that's the availability of the equipment, the right kind of equipment, the competencies in setting that equipment, the algorithms for hookup, depending on the surgical procedure we're doing, because it's all different. Big difference in a breast biopsy and a tonsillectomy. So it is a smoke evacuation system. And one of the biggest complaints we get with local exhaust ventilation is it was noisy. Well, today's systems with multiple companies have now worked so hard over the last 10 years to make it quiet and give a better control for hooking up. And they're being very aggressive with hospitals to assure that they're available in our operating room. When you got turnover times that have to be 20 minutes or less, and OR time $50 to $90 a minute, depending on where you live, you really need something that is available in the room immediately and make it part of every one of our procedures.
Yeah, absolutely. Weird question. Does the Joint Commission ever look at that kind of thing? Like, do they regulate that at all?
Joint Commission tests state standards, so does DNV, and it's a French acronym, so please don't. And then you got Quad A and Triple A, so they're all in harmony with what they deliver. And they say we should evacuate smoke. Now, I say this in utmost respect, but the knowledge base of your surveyor, regardless of the organization, and I know I'm bunny trailing here, is the education of those surveyors, so they know to ask the questions. When I had DNV visit at my last institution, they knew right away because we got the Gold Clear Award there, what surgical smoke was, and they were real proud. They have to ask the questions. If they don't ask the questions and target the situation, whether it's SPD or surgical smoke, then we don't get cited for it. How does that affect us long term? It affects CMS, who is regulatory, and that's our reimbursement. So I think Patty Owens and I are just joined at the hip. We do a lot of things like Kay, Patty, Brenda, and I. We're all kind of on the same wavelength, no pun intended with that. She goes to me, how do we educate our organizations that do accreditation? And that's one of the goals that we're talking about doing, that they need to know more. One of our board members, I won't mention her name, she actually worked for the Joint Commission, and we worked very closely, her and I, on the guidelines so Joint Commission knew what to ask when they came to the hospital, since they're the biggest organization that surveys. But we're not done yet. We have only skimmed the top with something that's been around over 30-something years with the risk.
Another question I have is I am always thinking about the EVS and facilities and stuff like that, and how much do they know, and how much education do you think they need that they're not getting now?
So you're referring to EVS? I'm going to say I can't throw a statistic on it, but if I walked anybody up to anybody with EVS, I bet they would have no idea. And I know I do this with lasers, and I think surgical smoke plume should be handled the same way. Everybody should know about it. What a collaborative voice you would have if we all knew. But we do that with lasers. We teach EVS not to walk in the room, put the glasses on. We don't do that with surgical smoke. We need to broaden our audience. And that's why I was so excited about being able to do this talk with you with infection control today. You reach an audience that is unaware sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. If you were speaking to hospital leadership, what would you say is the most urgent change needed to better protect staff and patients from laser and electrosurgery smoke.
It's always a hard sell, and I did that for a couple of hospitals. I'm very proud that I had five hospital conversions in my career. So I'm going to speak from my own personal experience. You can't manage what you can't make measurable. That sounds kind of crazy. So I can talk, whether it's to the surgeon, get your surgeons to support you about the hazards. And but I've also got to talk to administration. And the first thing they think about, oh, it costs a lot of money. Pricing gets in there right away. If you look at what an electrosurgical pencil runs, depending on your contract, $15 to $20 to attach a device on there that would optimize the removal of the surgical smoke is probably no more than $5 or $10. Or the corrugated tubing, where we don't even attach to a pencil, runs about $5 to $10. And most of your companies will place the systems like we do with, other types of equipment that remove fluid and everything else at just the cost of purchasing the disposable exclusively from their company. So back to administration, I've got to come in two ways, financially, and I got to show them the risk. And I also show them the opportunity when we take care of our staff. More staff, nurses, surgical techs would have a tendency to come to your hospital because they know you care, and recruitment. So it is a tough sell a lot
Yeah.
of times.
Well, you're probably going to get less turnover because people are going to say, okay, this company has what I want. This, I know that, like you said, I know they care. So I'm not going to go somewhere else because I'm afraid they may not have it.
I agree. They want to know you care. More people leave their organizations either due to the leadership not caring. A good leader is who they want to work under, to be honest with you. And they care about their surgical safety. The other issue that is the missing link there, you said it earlier, Tori, we're not educating our staff readily. It shocks you that we're talking about all this, and I could do a presentation that's 2 hours on this. We're skimming the top, but all we have to do is start educating these people. Why wouldn't they care what's happening in their lives and what they're bringing home? They did that with HIV, if you remember that years ago, or COVID. In fact, some of the protection means we did with COVID were smoke evacuation systems because the viral particulates of COVID were like surgical smoke. We actually did that at the last hospital I worked with, Atlanta. We hooked up the evacuators on intubation and extubation because aerosolization occurred. And we figured we'd limited the exposure to our staff.
That's just incredible innovation. Wow. Is there anything else that you would like to add for this particular discussion?
I think the biggest thing in the end, and I was talking to my peer group, the three people that I communicate with, K-Ball, I'm going to give them some pluses there, Patty Owens and Brenda Ulmer. And we talk about legislation and law implementation and how that's going to change things. I think our biggest barrier and take home is not just educating all avenues of individuals that are in healthcare so they can collaborate with us to take care of us. But compliance and culture change is the biggest barrier. We've got to let them understand, just like we have safety syringes, this is the same thing. Or why do we have timeout protocols or hands-free passing or ergonomics and doing the proper thing with lifting devices? Let's don't wait till we've hurt ourselves or caused a compromise in somebody's life before we make this compliance and culture change. That's the take home.
Absolutely. Vanjie, as always, it's wonderful to see you, and thank you so much for this wonderful discussion.
Pleasure too, Tori, always.
Thank you.
You're welcome.